It's 10 o'clock. From WJFF in Jeffersonville, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, the COVID vaccines are here. Or are they? Wayne County paused distribution this week due to an overwhelming demand. In New York, the governor says the feds haven't supplied enough doses. We'll get the latest. Mental health issues have skyrocketed since the COVID-19 pandemic, and the very rules to keep people safe from the virus are doing great damage when it comes to anxiety, depression, and even suicide. We'll speak with Sullivan 180 about their efforts to raise awareness around suicide with a prevention course. Plus, the latest developments at the Sullivan County Care Center. Madam C.J. Walker, the visionary philanthropist and African-American business pioneer who's often overlooked. And a new contributor, Leif Johansson, joins us with a closer look at the community through the eyes of Gen Z. But first, the news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Giles Snyder. President-elect Joe Biden is laying out the details of his plan to speed up vaccine distribution as the U.S. nears 400,000 deaths from the coronavirus. NPR's Windsor Johnston reports on Biden's plan after he called the rollout under the Trump administration a dismal failure.
Biden is pledging to correct course and meet the goal for distributing 100 million shots in his administration's first 100 days.
We will immediately work with states to open up vaccinations to more priority groups. The process of establishing priority groups is driven by science, but the problem is the implementation has been too rigid and confusing.
Biden says he'll use the Defense Production Act to increase the supply of vaccines. His plan also includes the creation of vaccination centers across the country and mobile clinics to reach underserved urban communities and rural areas. Windsor Johnston, NPR News.
California and other states, including Wisconsin, Illinois, and Michigan, are working to avoid what happened at the U.S. Capitol last week. They're beefing up security ahead of Joe Biden's inauguration on Wednesday. Demonstrations are expected to begin this weekend. In Florida, prosecutors say a man has been charged with trying to organize an armed response to pro-Trump protesters expected at the state capitol in Tallahassee tomorrow. Before Senators-elect John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock can be sworn into the U.S. Senate, Georgia must certify the results of the January 5th runoff elections. From member station WABE in Atlanta, Christopher Alston reports.
Today is the deadline for election officials in Georgia's 159 counties to certify the results of the state's two Senate races last week. All except a few dozen counties had completed their certification as of Thursday afternoon. Georgia's Secretary of State's office will review the certifications after the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday weekend. They must certify results for the state by next Friday, January 22nd. Once the Secretary of State certifies, the results are to be confirmed by the governor, then delivered to the U.S. Senate. Georgia must complete its certification process before Democrats can establish their majority in the Senate. For NPR News, I'm Christopher Alston in Atlanta.
The party of German Chancellor Angela Merkel has elected a new leader. Pro-business politician Armin Laschet offers a clear continuation of Merkel's policies. And as NPR's Rob Schmitz reports, he's now one of the top contenders to replace Merkel as chancellor.
For more than 3 years, Armin Laschet has served as the premier of North Rhine-Westphalia, Germany's most populated state. As a politician, the 60-year-old Laschet has been a close ally of Chancellor Angela Merkel and, as candidate for chairman of the Christian Democratic Union Party, offered a clear continuation of her policies. As chairman of the CDU, Laschet is now one of the top contenders to replace Angela Merkel as chancellor at the end of this year.
And you're listening to NPR News. India has launched what it's calling the biggest vaccination campaign in the world. The first dose is being administered today, as NPR's Lauren Freyer reports from Mumbai.
The first Indians to be vaccinated today were nurses and other frontline healthcare workers, including this woman, Anamika Kumari, in the eastern state of Bihar. I feel fine, she says, encouraging everyone to follow suit. India has approved two formulas, the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine and another from an Indian company called Bharat Biotech. The latter is still in phase 3 clinical trials, and some scientists and public health experts say it was rushed out too quickly. Recipients do not get to choose which one they receive. India aims to vaccinate 300 million people by July, but it could take 2 years to vaccinate all nearly 1.4 billion Indians. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, Mumbai.
Main opposition candidate in Thursday's presidential election in Uganda says security forces are not allowing anyone in or out of his home today. Bobby Wine says the government is isolating him. Wine spoke by phone to NPR as election officials announced longtime leader Yoweri Museveni won re-election. Wine alleges widespread fraud and is calling on Ugandans to reject the results. Rescuers in Indonesia dealing with the threat of aftershocks as they search for survivors following yesterday's 6.2 magnitude earthquake. At least 46 people are confirmed dead, hundreds injured. The quake struck Indonesia, collapsed buildings, damaged roads and bridges, and cut off electricity. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Tableau, providing analytics designed for people to find the insights needed to solve today's complex challenges and the resiliency to drive business forward. More at Tableau.com/NPR.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The first COVID-19 vaccines are here, but due to limited supply from the federal government, availability is limited. In New York and in Pennsylvania, there's a phased approach and demand is high. In Wayne County, the demand for the vaccine during phase 1A distribution has been so great that the hospital has temporarily suspended registration. Here's Executive Director of Wayne Memorial Community Health Center's Fred Jackson with more information. We should note that Wayne Memorial is a financial supporter of WJFF.
Phase 1A consists of direct health care workers and long-term care residents. We will have given out close to 2,000 vaccines between ourselves and the hospital has a separate allocation too. But in those numbers too, we're starting to drift into the 1Bs there. In those numbers, it's not, you know, the thing is, it's not exclusive to say, okay, you know, and in the 1Bs are some, we did some specifically a 75 plus clinic. You know, we have, you know, whether they're teachers in the 1Bs, you know, 1B is a pretty all encompassing category, including, teachers, 75 plus, grocery store workers, manufacturers, transportation, police, corrections officers, and the like, and firefighters. As we started to go into the 1B, that's where we were told, hey, we have to hold back on resupply. Or interruption to the supply till the rest of the state catches up with us. This is a state thing. And I don't say that in a critical fashion. I mean, they're the task in the Department of Health is monumental, and they've been great to work with and everything. And, we work with them routinely on vaccination programs. And these are the colleagues that we've worked with for years and years. And they're good people. They just have a huge task in front of them. We obviously are here to advocate for our counties and our residents. And so we want, frankly, we don't really care if the other people are behind. We're not, and we want vaccine supplies. And, the infrastructures in Pennsylvania are different than New York. In our scenario, it's a statewide immunization bureau, which is a division of the Department of Health, that we work with, and we are a registered COVID vaccine, distribution site. We're hoping that if you call me next Friday, I'd like to tell you we're open because we, have a confirmation of a commitment for a shipment on the week of the 25th. So, this is a low. This isn't the 3 month low. I think it's probably more of a week long low. You know, that's pure conjecture at this point. We want to assure people that what we've seen so far in the couple thousand doses there's a little arm pain, what you get when the flu shot or, whatever, goes away in a day. We had one patient
breakout in hives, which was addressed with epinephrine. And we had one patient, employee, that had to go home sick the next day. And, you know, this is on the Moderna, you know, and there are different complication levels between ones, but ours have been very minimal, nothing serious. You know, next week we start with the employees on the second dose. Second dose is supposed to be a little more intense, a little more. Maybe you're sick for 12 hours, maybe you're sick for a day. And about, you know, 10 or 20% of the population, we're trying to review that data too. But at the same time, we're seeing long-term pulmonary impacts like a healthy person with lungs that look like they were a lifetime smoker from getting COVID vaccine. So it has long-term implications in between the vaccine and the disease. I'll take the vaccine any day. I just continue to reiterate it's safe. You know, right now, our goal is to get this community-wide immunity, and, you know, it helps them. It's the same with the flu vaccine, that, you know, your immunity will help, you know, when you go visit grandma, because you've got the immunity, and so you won't carry the disease to her and or him in that manner. And that's the same advice for the routine flu that we have, because it helps in that manner as well. We will publicize when we will open up our registration platform. We're working on to make our vaccine platforms easier. You know, right now is our capacity is to vaccine 500 a day. You know, we're working on getting to the point where we can vaccine 1,000 a day, and we will continue to grow our capabilities until we're done, until we get everybody that wants a vaccine vaccinated.
This week in New York, Governor Andrew Cuomo announced that the initial groups of Phase 1B are now eligible to receive the COVID-19 vaccine. But what is Phase 1B in this state, and who is now eligible? We asked Dr. Ken Desa, Acting Chief Medical Officer of Sun River Health. Sun River is a financial supporter of WJFF.
You're looking at anyone over the age of 65, all first responders, fire service, police, public safety communicators, any court personnel, people in corrections, people involved in the schools, childcare workers, public transit, people living in homeless shelters, grocery store workers, and college instructors. You know, a very, very broad range of people. And this is the key, because these are our frontline people, and they are helping keep our communities functional and safe. So this is exciting.
Even though more people are eligible for vaccines, Dr. Desa reiterated that it will still be some time before enough people are vaccinated. Until then, the usual precautions apply.
We have to look at this disease as a collective disease. It is not an individual mandate, but one where your behavior really has an impact on what happens to those around you. And so following the basic rules, you know, washing your hands, using a mask, keeping your distance, social distance of 6 feet or more, avoiding crowded areas, you know, holding back on big gatherings. These are all things that are going to cause some short-term pain, absolutely, but in the longer term, it's going to bring us relief and control and get our lives back to some semblance of normality.
And as we've noted, one of the big problems with the rollout of the COVID-19 vaccine is logistics, getting enough vaccines to enough places. In fact, the New York government website about COVID-19 has a red alert, literally in red alert, over 7 million New Yorkers are eligible for the vaccine, but the state only receives 300,000 doses per week from the federal government. And even though there will be those vaccines coming through, another major problem is whether people choose to get it, whether it's a mistrust of science, a mistrust of government, or one of any number of wild conspiracy theories. Many people have a reason that they say they are reluctant to get vaccinated. We asked Dr. Desa what he would say to someone who feels that way.
There's no hidden agenda here. Why would anyone generate a vaccine to make people even worse. It just does not make sense. Vaccines are here to protect us. And those of us who are old enough during the period of smallpox and polio realize the devastation those diseases caused. We are very, very fortunate. We live in an era where most of those diseases are not part of our lives. And that's because vaccines have helped control them. And now we have the opportunity once again to show what vaccines can do. Part of this requires us to get out of our comfort zone, listen to reason, to listen to science, and follow a good behavior. And that's ultimately what you've got to do.
To get the facts about the COVID-19 vaccine in New York, go to covid19vaccine.health.ny.gov. In Pennsylvania, health.pa.gov. When we come back, we'll have a report and more information about the spike in anxiety, depression, and suicide. This is Radio Chatskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, and do you know digital? WJFF is seeking volunteers to help execute our social media and website strategies. Experience is appreciated, but training is also available. Be part of your community radio station. Join the digital team at Radio Catskill. Contact manager at WJFFradio.org.
I pledge to be a president who seeks not to divide, but unify.
After a turbulent transition of power, Joe Biden now inherits many challenges in a divided nation. He's set to be inaugurated on the same stage where rioters overtook the Capitol. I'm Rachel Martin. Join NPR Wednesday for special live coverage of the inauguration from NPR News.
On Radio Catskill, public radio for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania, keeping you connected.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Since the COVID-19 pandemic arrived, depression and anxiety in America have become rampant. Federal surveys show that 40% of Americans are now grappling with at least one mental health or drug-related problem. And other folks are, even more alarming, struggling with suicide. Americans' system for monitoring suicides is broken and slow, and experts won't know until roughly 2 years after the pandemic whether suicides have risen nationally. But locally, Sullivan 180 is already seeing some of that rise and troubling signs. We spoke with Jenny Sanchez from Sullivan 180 about their upcoming suicide prevention course to raise awareness about the issue.
There has been an increase in isolation due to the pandemic and more people needing to stay home. And there's been an increase in anxiety rates and depression rates shown across the country. We have seen that in Sullivan County as well when you look at why people call different helplines and what reasons people are reaching out for.
When it comes to suicide prevention, especially during this unusual time, there's so much volatility. What could folks look for in order to try to help someone who might be in crisis?
One of the signs to look for is if someone is becoming more socially withdrawn, if they're usually a bubbly person, if they're usually engaging with their friends, with their family, and you're noticing that they're doing that a bit less now. And they might be busy, but it's also good to just check in with them and see if something deeper is going on. It's also a big warning sign if someone starts to give away their possessions or makes comments that might not seem like direct verbal cues of saying their intentions, but if somebody starts saying, "Oh, you might not see me around anymore," or "I won't have to worry about that in the future because it won't be important by this time next week." Those are really concerning words to hear, and that should raise some red flags that something's going on and some questions should be asked.
Especially during this pandemic when we're asked to stay at home and stay away from people, it must be harder to try to notice that if people are isolating already because of fear of contagion. Is there anything else that we can look for, folks can pay attention to, in addition to the things that you mentioned?
So you're looking for any change, any more drastic change that you could notice in somebody, whether you live with them or whether you have an occasional contact with somebody, to say they've always presented as being this one way, and right now, since the pandemic or since 2 weeks ago, their energy seems lower, or they've been depressed for a long time and suddenly their energy seems very increased all of a sudden, or that they seem more hopeful. That can also be a concerning sign that they've made a decision to end their life. It's really if you notice a change in mood, behavior, if you notice how they present, if the way they're talking seems different all of a sudden, those are some signs. It could be something physical going on. It could be something else. But you don't know unless you ask or start to pick up on these.
It's important to keep an ongoing and an open dialogue, especially at this time. And as part of that, you're conducting a training course. What will folks learn in this training course?
So in this course, it's called QPR. It's a suicide prevention training that stands for Question, Persuade, Refer. And here we teach attendees how to question the person they're concerned about suicide, persuade the person to get help, and refer the person to the appropriate resource. So we talk to them about how to discuss difficult topics with depressed individuals, offer hope, and provide resources to help people who are struggling get the help that they need. And we also like to compare QPR to CPR. It's an invaluable and potentially life-saving emergency response aimed at those in crisis.
How long is the course, and what can other folks expect?
So it is a 60-minute online training followed by a 30-minute Q&A session, and this is for anybody 16 and older, and they will receive the training, some practical exercises, including role plays throughout this, so that you leave feeling comfortable and confident to ask that question moving forward. Is someone that they know considering suicide? And so we make sure to prepare them in those 60 minutes, and then the 30-minute Q&A session afterward is very important because there are a lot of questions surrounding this topic, and we want everybody to get a chance to say how they feel and ask away, basically. We also provide, after the training, a 42-page resource booklet with all of the information we go over, as well as local resources. So if somebody is asking that question and wants a guide to help them through it, or wants the phone numbers at their fingertips, they can have that. And I also provide extra practice materials that they can do on their own afterwards to ensure that there are no questions.
Jenny Sanchez from Sullivan 180, leading a free online suicide prevention course, which begins Monday the 18th. And there are repeat sessions in February, March, April, and May. More information at Sullivan180.org. Jenny, thank you so much for this invaluable work you're doing for the community.
Thank you. We're happy to help and be able to provide this.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno.
The care center at Sunset Lake has been in the spotlight as Sullivan County legislature explores its options to lease the facility. Sullivan County is one of only a few remaining counties in New York State that still operates a nursing home. In August, the legislature voted 8-1 to move the care center to a local development corporation in preparation for leasing. Opponents of the plan to lease the facility say the quality of care will suffer if the facility is privately run. One of those opponents is Kat Scott. She spoke with WJFF's Jason Dole about the latest meeting about the care center this week.
For those who don't know, can you just give us a quick brief of what is happening with the care center? We're at the point where basically an LDC, a local development corporation, was set up. And then the last I heard, they were looking into somebody to take over it, I guess.
That is correct. The LDC was formed and they've been having meetings. They put out an RFP, a request for proposals from interested parties. All of that information has been kept private and secret. On Tuesday, the LDC announced the three candidates that they have chosen to present to the county legislature. And Wednesday, they announced that there was going to be an emergency meeting because they did not have enough time to schedule a meeting appropriately. So that becomes an emergency meeting of the LDC and the legislature, a joint meeting. And they were going to discuss, the LDC was going to discuss the three candidates that they have chosen. I attended a full day of committee meetings and took every opportunity I could to speak during public comment about one of the candidates who I find wholly, completely unacceptable. And when it came time for the emergency meeting, they started the meeting, they took roll call for the legislature, roll call for the LDC, and then they told us that they were going into executive session and that the public had to leave. On their own agenda, they had public comment. I asked, well, what about public comment? We're not doing that. We don't have to. I said, it's on your own agenda. We're not doing it. Ken Walter, who is who is a very experienced man when it comes to open meetings, open government meetings, because he's attended many in his life, he's sat on many boards, said, why are you going into executive session? You don't have to go into executive session. And the chairman, Mr. Doherty, told him that they were doing it to discuss a potential vendor. And he said, yeah, but you're not discussing an actual contract. You're discussing candidates. And Mr. Doherty didn't want to discuss it. He did not want to give the public any reasoning for his decision, and we were effectively removed from, well, asked to leave, and there was many people there who were upset about that, people who took time out to attend this meeting so that they could speak out and be heard by the legislature and by the LDC, and what I did is I actually recorded the meeting, and outside in the hallway I recorded them, and I'm in the process of putting that up onto Facebook right now. Because we feel like this process has not been transparent. We don't feel like the public is being given a fair shake. And yeah, we want the public to get our due because it's our asset. It's our tax dollars that have been going into creating this facility, and it's our loved ones in this facility serving our community. So we have a big stake in it, and we just really believe that, you know, we should be informed and able to have a discussion with the legislature as they're making this incredibly important decision.
Did you hear from any of the legislators after the meeting?
No, I have not. I also have not reached out to anyone because, like I said, I commented at every public meeting. I have a feeling they may be a little sick of hearing from me. Sometimes I like to give them a little bit of a break. But no, I am going to follow up with the legislators because there was a very interesting discussion that happened in the special meeting before the emergency meeting. So there was a special meeting called, and during that public comment, quite a few people got up and spoke, and we were trying to determine who actually gets to make the decision about the care center. The legislature is under the impression that they will have the final say as to who the contract goes to, but the LDC technically owns the care center, and they are not bound to the legislature's choice. And that was said during one of the LDC meetings by one of the LDC board members. The county attorney is saying that the legislature gets the final say, but Honestly, from my research, and I've consulted with an attorney who is familiar with working with LDCs, that's not what I've been told. So we kept asking questions like, are you sure that's the way it's, are you sure that that's the law? And if the county attorney's wrong, what is the consequence for this? If the legislature does not get to choose and the LDC chooses outside of what the legislature wanted, where is the public recourse? Where is the consequence?
There's what the law says, but then there's also the process as it had been laid out initially. How much of this, and I mean like from what you're saying about the LDC, also from just the introduction of what the potential vendors are to this actual meeting, how much of this does or does not comport with what, in your opinion, you were told this process would be like at the beginning?
It stinks. It just all stinks. And that's why I keep showing up to these meetings and I keep speaking out. And that's why there are so many people that have joined me to raise their voices as well.
But is the legislature doing what they told you that they were going to do? Is this process following the process that they laid out, or is it shifting on you?
It's funny because I think that some of the legislators are operating under good faith and they are operating under one belief system and others are operating under a different. So honestly, to answer your question, yes and no. So I think a lot of the problem comes down to when the county attorney is asked a question, sometimes the answer changes. And for example, when asked, how do we take the sale language out of the resolution for this, the care center? We just want to lease it. Several of the legislators, five of them, voiced that they did not want to sell. And there is sale language in the resolution. The county attorney said, well, in order to change the sale language, you would have to bring the, you would have to have a vote of six to bring the care center back into our ownership from the LDC. Change the language and then vote to give it back to them. And at one point it was like, well, no, we retain ownership, but no, the LDC retains our ownership. So a lot of this is very murky. And even some of the legislators have voiced their own confusion over what's happening during this entire process. So what we were told and what's happened, and no, it hasn't been transparent, it hasn't been clear, and I think a lot of the pushback that I'm getting and my fellow members of the public is because we keep asking questions and trying to shine a light on this. And I've called it a rush-hush job from the beginning, and that's true. They have very quickly tried to push this process through, and the more we try to slow them down, the more questions we ask them. Quite frankly, the more pushback we get and the angrier they seem to be with us. So, no, I don't believe that the process has gone as they told us it would. And I don't fault all of the legislators for that. I think some of them have been operating under good faith that I frankly don't believe they should have.
What do you think the next steps are as far as you are concerned? What are you looking for to happen next, or what are you looking to do next?
Well, we were told that these three candidates will have to come and give a presentation, that there would be a public hearing. And that's what I'm looking forward to.
Is that what you thought was going to happen today?
Today, I thought that the LDC was going to discuss with the legislature in front of us some of the process of how they went about choosing these three candidates. I thought we were going to hear their vetting process, what they did to disqualify some, and how, one, the Grand Healthcare Systems, which I find to be a unacceptable choice, how they ended up on the short list. And we weren't given that opportunity. Instead, they claimed privilege and they locked us out.
Then, to be clear, though, you were still expecting and are still expecting, even after today's meeting, that there will still be a public presentation of who these potential vendors, buyers are.
Yes, okay. And that was said today. So I expect that public hearing. I expect that public meeting where the public gets to hear who these three companies are and what their plan is and how they plan to care for our elders. And we expect an opportunity to be heard and to speak out or for one of the one of the choices. So I don't have a lot of faith in the system, Jason, to be honest, but I have to continue thinking that perhaps at one point they will do what they said they were going to do.
You know, whatever happens, my assumptions are we're going to hear about it, and you're going to be one of the people that we hear about it from. So whatever happens, I think we're going to be talking again.
Anytime, absolutely. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to be heard. And people can always find me on Facebook. I post frequently, and everything that I post on this topic is always open to the public. So I implore people to please pay attention, because it's not just about the care center. It's about how our county government is operating and whether or not they're respecting us as a public and understanding the relationship between the public and the elected officials.
Kat Scott, thank you for letting us know what's going on.
Thank you, Jason.
Sullivan County Legislative Chairman Robert Doherty told Mid-Hudson News recently that the legislature has made it clear from the beginning that the quality of care and the safety of the residents at the county's nursing home is a top priority. He says, quote, "One of the public misperceptions is that the county nursing home is currently free. That has never been the case. Residents who are not covered by insurance, Medicare, or Medicaid must pay out of pocket just like a private facility. Our ultimate goal is to increase the quality of care for the residents of the care center while reducing the burden on the taxpayer. When you look at the ratings published by the federal government, the private nursing home facilities in Sullivan County are on top, and we are at the bottom. Sullivan County is long overdue to address this issue." End quote. When we come back, celebrating the first female African-American millionaire, Madam C.J. Walker. We'll be right back.
It's been a disorienting time, so on last week's Wait, Wait, we asked exotic foreigner Maeve Higgins for her perspective on it all.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? A lot of people are like, this is not America. And I'm like, but I've only ever seen this in America.
I'm Peter Sagal. What a country, huh? Join us as we explore American exceptionalism with singer Phoebe Bridgers on this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Many Americans have a limited idea of Madam C.J. Walker. Born in 19th century rural Louisiana to former slaves, Sarah Breedlove, who became known as Madam C.J. Walker, rose to become the first female African-American self-made millionaire in the United States. She developed a multinational line of 23 hair and beauty care products for black women and built a factory, hair salon, mail order business, and a beauty school which trained 20,000 sales agents. At the forefront of her advertising strategy was something unheard of at the time. Walker acknowledged that black was beautiful and she wanted to enhance it however she could. Later, she became a philanthropist and was active in organizing the NAACP's silent protest parade in New York in 1917. On Thursday, historian Rick Feingold, who teaches American business history at Bergen Community College and Mount St. Mary's College, hosts a virtual talk for the E.B. Crawford Library in Monticello about Madam Walker.
Well, hers is a fascinating story because we look at where she started out in Louisiana, I think it was Delta, Louisiana. I mean, it's pretty far off from a city where, whatever, you develop these things. And where she ended up, which was this lavish estate, Irvington-on-Hudson in New York. And so the early part of her life was fairly typical. She was married three times. Her first marriage was at 14 years old, had one child, worked as a housekeeper or laundress, nothing that would particularly stand out. And then, I guess about the time her daughter was grown, she had moved to St. Louis. Her brothers were barbers. She learned the hair care business from them. And then started working as a sales agent for what would be a competitor of hers, but Annie Turnbow Malone, whose operation was in St. Louis. And then she ran with it. So that was about 1904, and she was in her mid-30s. And she basically said to herself, oh, I can do this, and essentially copied the model from Annie Turnbull Malone and became actually more successful. So she went on to first she was a sales agent and then created her own product line and her own mail order business and moved around a lot, a number of cities, Denver, Pittsburgh, and Indianapolis, and eventually New York, and essentially developed a system of commissioned sales agents. And she would teach them. She would bring them. She would. She opened her school, and she would teach them the business of really how to run your own business, and the business of selling her hair care products, which was not just the product, but how to take care of your hair. At that time, we're talking about what, more than 100 years ago, indoor plumbing wasn't common. Certainly hot water wasn't. And so it was the product with a combination of hair care. And it was this a line of, let's say, business schools or finishing schools or however you want to term it, that expanded her product reach.
What do you think it was that drove her? She, you know, really at the time, this was she was developing African American industry, and she also, as you said, created economic opportunities for women. And in addition to teaching them about how to care for their hair, these are all different sorts of lines that intersect. What was it that drove her in this way, do you think?
She was self-driven, and I think it was just the right time. I mean, this is a time period where going into business for yourself was essentially the way to make, you know, real money, because obviously there's the era of discrimination, segregation, and everything else. So if you wanted to move beyond, you know, obviously a low-paid job, you had to go into business for yourself. And it is really fascinating, the change from one sort of life to this other life. And her whole business occurs over a 15-year period. She dies young at 51 in 1919. It's just an amazing, you know, let's say, stretch there. She, I guess, had a vision, as every business, every successful business person does. And she worked very hard.
Her commitment to education is something that's also interesting, I think, to point out, that she believed in promoting a formal education through her schools, but also to give people opportunities to grow beyond that.
Yes, well, it was this school, which went on for many years, even after her death, or this kind of education, is really a model, because where there was no opportunities, it provided an opportunity to operate your own business. And whether you continued in that sort of sales field or went on to do something else, you were changed by it. And they were trained in ways of how to carry themselves, how to present themselves, they dressed a certain way. They had white shirts and black skirts, and they carried satchels and with the beauty products. And that was quite innovative at that time. I mean, we know that today, but back then, it was kind of revolutionary and pioneering.
Her legacy still lives on. Can you talk a little bit about the legacy of Madam C.J. Walker?
Well, her products, there was a Sundials brand's relaunch of the product, I guess, name, the formula, obviously something else in 2016, I believe. Here's what I kind of take away. When I speak in front of, I give this lecture three or four or five times a year, last few years, and it's amazing. White Americans don't really know of her, and African Americans do. The white Americans are fascinated by her story. They want to learn more. I mean, they like the story, and they embrace it. And, but when I mean, I didn't know about this until a few years ago. And once I discovered it, I was like amazed because I'd never heard of it. And also amazed because it was such a good story and such an inspiring story.
Rick Feingold is presenting his lecture at the E.B. Crawford Public Library about Madam C.J. Walker on January 21st at 6 p.m. More information at ebcpl.org. Thank you so much for joining us and talking about Madam Walker.
It's my pleasure, Tim. Thank you.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Generation Z refers to babies born from the late 90s through today. They are currently between 6 and 24 years old, and there are nearly 68 million Gen Z kids in the U.S. They grew up in a hyper-connected world, and the smartphone is their primary form of communication. Luckily for us, one of those Gen Zers is putting down his phone and picking up his microphone to learn more about our community through his generation's eyes. Leif Johansson joins us today as a regular contributor. Here's his first story.
One of the things that this pandemic has shown us is that we rely on a myriad of institutions in our day-to-day lives to support everything we do. Up until this year, I know I took these for granted. They worked quietly in the background, feeding us, healing us, educating us, and ensuring that every aspect of our world functioned seamlessly and without fail. But when we have such an overwhelming shock to our local, state, and national system, as in the case of the coronavirus pandemic, and these institutions falter, it's a wake-up call. It's a reminder that we are inexorably dependent on one another, sometimes in ways that are so minute and intricate that it's kind of hard to see all the connections. Back in middle school science class, I remember learning about how in a biological ecosystem, thousands of species are totally interconnected, so much so that it kind of works like a Jenga tower, this tall structure that's built out of all these small wooden blocks. And as you pull blocks out, the tower gets more and more unstable until it comes crashing down. This was always the argument for why it's dangerous to kill off a species. It's tough to tell to what extent doing so will upset the balance of the ecosystem. After living through this pandemic for almost a year, it's become a lot clearer that our social ecosystem operates in a similar way. When one of the sectors in our economy fails, it can so thoroughly upset a surprisingly careful balance for all of us, and that can have pretty serious consequences. That said, I have gained a deep respect for and curiosity about these institutions that keep us afloat here in our neck of the woods, which is exactly what we're going to explore. We're going to take a deep dive into a different local institution and talk with the folks that keep it running. We're going to look at agriculture, our educational system, our waste and recycling programs, rural transportation, mental health, and a whole lot more. Now, I'm certainly no expert on any of this stuff. I'm 22 years old with almost no life qualifications besides an undergrad degree. So my hope is that through these conversations and closer looks at how we operate as a sort of microcosm of the larger American society, we both learn a lot, have a lot of questions, and perhaps discover new ideas about what it means to live in and share a community. For my first stop, I wanted to get a better idea of some of the broader issues our community is facing before getting too far into the weeds on any specific topics. And who better to help me wade in than someone who's been around and involved for, well, a long time.
Well, I'm Charlie Barbeauty, and for some people, I'm not the Charlie Barbeauty because that would have been my father. I was born in Liberty, raised in Liberty, went to Liberty Central School, graduated in 1969. I went to State University of New York at Albany, math major, computer science minor, education minor, with plans to be a high school teacher. My father had worked at the furniture store that I retired from since 1946 as the manager for another corporation. The corporation wanted to get out of the furniture business, sold it to someone, and then that someone came in that ran it, fired my father. He said he always wanted to be in business for himself, so he rented a garage and he started selling furniture. And since I was the youngest boy, I had two older brothers, and my career was uncertain at the time, I came back to Liberty to help him get the business off the ground. And it prospered, and we wound up being in business from that time, 1973-74, until 2019.
Throughout much of Charlie's life and career in Liberty, he was involved in local politics, serving for a number of years as town supervisor. When I asked him what, in his view, have been some of the biggest changes in our community since he was growing up in the 50s and 60s, he had a unique perspective.
The biggest change I've seen, and it affects everybody's life, because everybody complains about their property taxes being too high. The reason that the property taxes are too high is because if you have a property tax structure that it relies upon commercial properties to pay the bulk of the taxes. If you have a community that's mostly residential, their taxes are going to be extremely high because you still have water, sewer, and all infrastructure, roads to plow. And nobody's ever come to grips with, well, what do we do now that we've lost the commercial properties? Just as an example, my father was a village trustee back in the 70s in Liberty. And at that time, half the assessed value of the town of Liberty was located in the village of Liberty. And half of the property tax assessments of the village of Liberty were, more than half, were on Main Street. And that burden has shifted because those properties are now not as profitable, and not a lot of them don't have going concerns in them. So that's the struggle we have here, how to provide the services to the people with and an affordable tax rate that everyone can afford to live here.
But, Charlie says, thanks to an influx of immigrants and, more recently, folks moving up from New York City to escape the coronavirus pandemic, there's a larger base of people for taxes to be distributed across, likely making life up here more affordable in the coming years.
But they've taken some real dilapidated buildings and put roofs on them, put storm windows on them, making a commitment to live here in Liberty. They like Liberty because of the closeness and the proximity. They can walk to different things. They can walk the kids to school. The school system is still attractive for a lot of these people. And it's just a wonderful thing to see, because when they put that roof on that house and they paint that house, it preserves the assessed value of that house, which helps everybody in keeping our taxes affordable. Selling stuff in downtown, other than a Family Dollar store, which gives you what the things you need to, you know, your toilet paper and your tissues and all that stuff, is over. I mean, people don't buy stuff in stores. They just, the thing that people don't understand is that in a furniture store or any business, if you lose 5 to 6% of your business to the internet, only 5 or 6%, you don't have to lose the whole thing, just 5 or 6%. There's no reason for you to be in business anymore, because that 5 or 6% was the part that the owners or the partners in the business were. That was what was there then. When you sell something for $100, it might be $5 for the people that are investors in that business. So if you lose that 5% and cut you back down, you know, you don't get to the gravy until all your expenses are paid. So after all your expenses are paid, that's the 5%. And that part of the business is now gone. It's gone for retail stuff. You watch on Main Street and Main Street's Liberty and everywhere, it's changing over to service businesses, food services, yoga studios, fitness centers, anything that hairdressers, barbershops, services that you can't get on the internet. So that's my prediction, and I think everybody's going to see it come.
Leading up to my conversation with Charlie, I had been thinking a lot about the need for improved public transportation here in Sullivan County, which, by the way, is a topic we'll do an episode on down the road, no pun intended. But Charlie points out that in order to more effectively jumpstart a stronger business sector in the region, we need to tackle a different type of infrastructure first, broadband.
Our numbers compare to Appalachia. You know, the poverty numbers and the rural poverty numbers to Appalachia. Now, if you remember Franklin Roosevelt, in those, the Tennessee Valley Authority, they had no electricity in many, many areas in the country. And it took a federal commitment to the Tennessee Valley Authority to create the dams and the rivers. And that made a big difference and a big change down there. Once they had electricity, they were no longer in the 19th century. They were in the 20th century. And that was a huge government program that came about because we needed to make work for people because they didn't have work. And I'm thinking if we are to de-urbanize and have more people live in the country, we're going to have to figure out ways to make country living available for people by having things as transportation and internet. Let's not even get to transportation now. I mean, one of Congressman Delgado's main things was helping farmers and getting some internet to, you know, some form of decent internet to everyone in our region. And that hasn't happened in New York State. I mean, you got to make the big corporations. If you're going to want the cream, you got to take the rest of the gallon of milk besides the cream. You've got to give to everybody. Even if you got to run some things at a loss because you're doing it. And that's what, you know, internet's going to come before people get in cars to drive to work.
Finally, I asked Charlie about maybe the most pressing issue our community is facing right now, the coronavirus pandemic. His advice to the community is simple. It's tough to control this thing, so it's that much more important that we do every little thing we can to keep each other safe.
You know, I wrote out a Christmas letter this year that we always do to people on my Christmas card list. And I said, the one thing you can do when you wear a mask, you're telling other people that you love them. And I put that in my Christmas letter, because how can you go out without a mask when you know that as of now, right this minute, that's about the only thing that you can actually do to help this condition? I mean, in my family, we're doing all kinds of isolation. I'm in Liberty because I went to the doctor and I went to the eye doctor this week. And now I'm 14 days. I'm not going to go back to my bubble in the lake house to be with the family. I'm going to isolate myself. I mean, when something happens like this, you have to do all you can do. And that's the only thing I can do right now is wear a mask, isolate myself if I've been exposed to other people. I mean, I have my groceries delivered. I'm having all kinds of, you know, staying away from touching people, being around people. It's hard. It's impossibly hard. But we've got to do it. I sing in the chorus. No chorus last year. I play in the Calicoon Center band. No Calicoon Center band. I'm playing the tuba. I'm going to blow all those virus stuff out there from a tuba. I mean, but that's all you can do. There's nothing else that we can do. And other than what we've done, which is hopefully elect new leadership that's going to go in a new direction, and we're going to see more progress being made.
That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. Please remember, we are in the midst of a spike in positive COVID-19 cases. And as Charlie says, do your part. Be kind, wear a mask, and stop the spread. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Red Cottage, Inc., hand-picked vacation rentals located throughout the Catskills and Hudson Valley. RedCottageInc.com.
The nations are caught up with the drum major instinct. I must be first. I must be supreme. Our nation must rule the world. The nation in which we live is the supreme culprit. And I'm going to continue to say it to America, because I love this country too much to see the drift that it has taken.
Thank you, Dr. King. Saturday at noon on the Janice Adams Show.
Set it off with your host, Clyde Alvin Yates III. Set it off.
Saturday night at 7.
Set it off.
On Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, W233AH Monticello.
Support for Farm and Country comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, a community-supported, science-based nonprofit, taking legal actions, providing tools for action, and raising awareness of fracking damage since 2008, proactively protecting public health in the Delaware River Basin and beyond. Damascus